For our next talk, we're going to get into the discussion about prior preservation. Dr. Reichman spoke about it briefly last evening. We're going to have a full share on this idea. We spoke about it in the past years as well in terms of using it for a variety of different conditions to preserve fertility. And without further ado, Rabbi Reichman.
Stand up and stretch a little bit while we're waiting to get the PowerPoint on, and I'll make a brief literary comment on the artificial womb. For those of you who are experts in Shakespeare, which I am not, for those of you who remember Macbeth, Macbeth was told by the witches that no harm would come to him from man or woman born. And at the end, he was undone by Macduff, because Macduff was actually born through cesarean section and not through normal birth. So now, in the modern iteration of Macbeth, Macduff would be born through an artificial womb.
Right.
So he wouldn't be man or woman born, and if you will, he would be man of womb born. Oh, I have the clicker, great. Okay, it's about to get very cold in here, so please prepare. Okay, so we are going to talk about today, as Lane said. First of all, where else in the world can you have lectures on CRISPR and the artificial womb, which is literally the most advanced technology in the world today, from a halachic perspective? Yeah, give a round of applause to by the way, Aaron, as far as I'm concerned, you could have gone till 11:20. I'd much rather hear you than hear me. So we're going to talk about global freezing, if you will, cryopreservation in Jewish law. And some of these aspects I suspect you will have heard of or will be familiar with to you, some of which I suspect you will not have heard of. Really, cutting-edge technologies in the world of cryopreservation. And we've come a long way from just freezing kugel on Shabbos. So here's the outline for today. Today we're going to talk about the preservation of the human body in rabbinic literature in the pre-modern era. And then we're going to shift into the modern era and talk about cryopreservation in modern medicine. Preservation of the human body in rabbinic literature. Let's start with some interesting examples. This is actually the story of Lot. Shemin Tiral Sodom Velamora Befrisva Eish Meisa Shemin Shamaim. And we all know that the wife of Lot turned around about Tehin and Tziv Melach, and she became a pillar of salt. Actually, if you do tours in Israel, they will point to this. Has anyone actually been on a tour that's seen the pillar of salt from Lot? So they actually say that this is the very pillar which became a pillar of salt, was originally Aish's Lot. There's an interesting paper on this by Professor Klotz, which appeared a number of years ago, explaining actually, there's an entire endeavor explaining all biblical miracles, all biblical events from a physiological perspective. It's not without its precedent in our Hashgafa. I mean, we do believe that there is an approach that all the miracles derive ultimately from an aspect of nature, and our Kaddish Baruch Hu does his miracles through that. This is one example of that. Which one of these is the... here we go. From a chemical perspective, explaining how Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt, says, thus by turning around in her direction of flight, Mrs. Lot exposed herself instantly to stresses that generated immediate enormous escalations in concentrations of calcium and carbon dioxide, so that the critical limits specified by equation 6 were exceeded overwhelmingly and instantaneously. Internal massive pervasive crystallization of calcite followed immediately. Mrs. Lot died instantly of rigor calcium carbonatus. Don't expect you knew that. That's something you can walk away with today. Another area which I'm sure you're all familiar with is the embalming of the Torah. It's a means of preserving the human body, but that's preserving it in its death. We're going to talk towards the end, preserving the human body to ultimately maintain its life. These are psukim which we don't need to read inside, which share with you that both Yaakov and Yosef were embalmed. There are interesting issues about the embalming, because the embalming process in Egypt is quite an extensive process, involves the complete evisceration of all the organs, involves actually inserting instruments. The embalming process in ancient Egypt is described in the literature of antiquity. It involves inserting instruments into the nostrils and extracting the brain tissue, a very invasive process which could involve a number of prohibitions, including Nivul Hamet, the desecration of the body, and of course, Halanat Hamet. If the embalming process, the body is kept above ground in the embalming process, then you wouldn't be burying the body, and that'd be delaying the burial. There's some other interesting aspects of the embalming process which affect the halachic discussions. Depriving the deceased of kapara, or forgiveness, from the body's decomposition. So according to Chazal, when the body decomposes, it's a penitence for the sins that we performed during our lifetimes. If you prevent that decomposition, you might actually be preventing someone's penitence, preventing someone's kapara. And that could be an interesting aspect in the embalming process. And there's another aspect which is discussed in Chazal, is that kasharina lemeis, lemachak bebasar achai, which is in Pirkei Avos and in the Gemara, that the human being, even after death, can feel the pain of the worms which are eating the flesh of the body after death. That itself is a fascinating discussion, not for today, but what exactly does that mean? Is that a metaphorical, metaphysical concept? Is it actually a physiological concept? Is there actually pain perception for the human being after death and its halachic value? So there is a debate amongst the rabbinic authorities about whether indeed Yaakov and Yosef were embalmed. So for example, Yonasan ben Uzziel, Adas Kane, Vibaliatosos seem to imply that this was a modified embalming, that maybe the body was placed in some honey or spices to preserve it externally, but not that there was a complete evisceration which would constitute a perhaps prohibited form of embalming. The Zohar also says that this was, this is a mistake actually on the slide, it should be this is not, it was not like other forms of embalming. However, others believe that the embalming of Yaakov and Yosef were indeed complete embalming, and one of those is the Rashba. The Rashba was asked the following question relating to the issue of the decomposition of the body, which we alluded to just a few minutes ago. The Rashba was asked the question, if a person died, and in those days, the way it worked, is that people died far away from the burial plot of the family, they couldn't transport the body. So today you just put a plane, and put a body on the plane, within a few hours it arrives at its destination. In the old days, you have to travel weeks, sometimes months, to get to a different destination. The body would decompose on the way. It was simply prohibitive. It would preclude the family from transporting the body immediately after death to the burial plot. So what they would do is they would keep the body above ground, actually, or in caves, what they called kuchin, connected to the ground to fulfill the requirement to burial from a halachic perspective. And you see these burial caves when you go on these archaeological tours in Israel. You may wonder to yourself, you know, we always bury underground, and I'm going to these archaeological sites of Jews, and they're buried in these caves. What's the disconnect? So the truth is, they used to bury in these caves. They would allow the body to completely decompose, and then they would put the body into a, it's called an ossuary. And you may be familiar with it, was an ossuary which was discovered, but they thought it was the brother of Yoshke. It had the name in Hebrew of the brother of Yoshke, and they thought that it was actually his ossuary, so there's a matter of archaeological debate there. But they found these little boxes, little caskets in stone, and some archaeologists thought that you know, maybe this was a society of dwarfs because they were all like this big, but in actuality they weren't. It was just a bone box in essence, and the bones were placed in these boxes. And the Gemara actually talks about, and the Halacha talks about likut atzamos, which is a gathering of the bones. They would take the bones from one location, transport them to another location. You'd actually have to sit a day of Shiva during the time that the bones were transported from one place to another. So the question here was asked, if a family wanted to bury the body quicker, could could they use quicklime, which is a chemical substance, and place it on the body, which would hasten the decomposition of the body, so the body would decompose a lot faster than normally would. So normally it would take like a few weeks, a few months. You put on the quicklime, it would take a few days to a few weeks. So the issue which he talked about in the preservation of the body here was precisely that issue we talked about before, about the decomposition of the body, and the slow decomposition of the body is a kapara, is a penitence for the sins that one had during the course of their lifetime. Can you deny the person that penitence? And these are what he talked about, and the Radbaz also talked about. But in this case, since it was done not for a negative reason, but for a positive reason, for the honor of the deceased, they permitted it in those cases. An interesting discussion about the physiology of decomposition, physiology of postpartum pain perception. That's an alliterative statement. And this was the Maamar Chazal I was talking about. Kosher rima lemeis kemacha gobasar achai. That the worm to the deceased, to the corpse, is like a needle to the living flesh. So there's a very interesting passage. Historically, this was written by a man by Ben Sion HaKohen Fritzi, not a very known figure today. He was quite a popular figure in his time in Italy. He actually wrote a collection of svarim on the science and scientific and medical aspects of Chazal, 6 volumes, thousands of pages. It's interesting that today no one is really familiar with it. But he tried to jive, basically like we do in these conferences, he tried to jive all the modern medicine of his time that was found in the Gemara and Midrashim with the science which was known at that time. He actually took this Maamar Chazal and interpreted it in the way of what was then a very modern development in the world of physiology. And he quotes the famous Hachacham HaGadol Halero, is referring to Albrecht Haller, who actually, for those of you who are going to be joining for the tour this afternoon, we're going to see the original works of Haller, and we'll discuss him in another Jewish context. But he mentions the physiological work of Haller, where they actually took deceased bodies and provided electrical stimulation to the muscles and saw that there was muscular contraction. So he interpreted that work of Haller as a way of interpreting the Maamar Chazal of Kasher Rima Lemeis Kemacha Bebasar Achai. In the famous question about autopsy, the questioner to Yecheskel Landau, which is the first tshuva of autopsy in rabbinic literature back in the 1700s, turned to the embalming of Yaakov and Yosef as an example of maybe we should allow anatomical dissection, because anatomical dissection has positive values. Clearly, our forefathers, Yaakov and Yosef, had some type of invasive procedures to them, which was for positive purposes as well. Interesting tangent also, the Egyptian mummies themselves, in a period of history which spanned actually a few hundred years, were actually themselves, the actual bodies of Egyptian mummies, were used for medicinal purposes. So this is not for today, but it's a very fascinating historical evolution. Started back from antiquity, but really it's achieved its prominence in the Middle Ages, where they literally went to Egypt, did grave robbing, took extracts from the corpse of Egyptian mummies, and mixed it with spices, and used it for medicinal purposes. And who do you think was in charge of the mummy trade in the Middle Ages? The Jews. The Jews were in charge of the mummy trade. So the famous Jew of the Radbaz, they asked the Radbaz, because I'm sure there are people in his congregation who are involved in the mummy trade, is it permissible to use this extract from the Egyptian mummy? And he had a fascinating tshuva. By the way, this tshuva is invoked today in modern discussions of kashrus, because he talked about the transformation from the human body, from the extraction of the human body to the shelf of the pharmacist, and the fact that there's a status change which might affect its kashrus. And there are shilohs about the preserved human body, whether Kohanim could enter the British Museum and other places which contain these things. And there are other halachic shilohs about embalming. So that's enough about embalming. That's a wrap. Okay, folks, that's a wrap. human body is also preserved in the 1700s-1800s. There were museums called Cabinets of Curiosities. For those of you who've done any medical history tours or any medical history travel, especially in Europe, even here in the United States, you've been to the Mutter Museum. Anyone been to the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia? Or been to the Hunterian Museum in London? So in the 1700s-1800s, they would actually preserve human bodies and show them for medical training and for other purposes, as we'll see in a minute. So here you have a tshuva about the Binyan Sion. He was asked, this is a sad case, Ishi Yisraeli sepilash nefel shekvar nigmar be'evarav. Actually this is not the sad case, but the sad case is the next one. This is a woman who had a miscarriage, unfortunately. It's also sad, but the physicians just wanted to embalm it and use it in their medical training, to keep it in a jar on the table and use it to teach their students. So is preserving the body in this way considered permitted or not? Mm-hmm. And the Binyan Sion talks about the issues. Is there an obligation to bury? And there is actually an interesting debate about whether burial applies to a fetus. The burial clearly applies to an adult. But is there a technical legal obligation? Is there a derivation of benefit in Isser Hanah? One of the main issues is a fetus clearly is metame, generates tumor for a kohen. And if the fetus is kept above ground, there's a concern that a kohen could potentially be exposed to tumah. This is the case of Yonos and Ivershitz, of a man who was dirt poor, and his wife gave birth to a very severely deformed congenital abnormalities fetus. And he wanted to preserve the fetus and travel and obtain money for people to look at the fetus, which was not uncommon, like the circuses of the time or the cabinet curiosities of the time. So he talks about the same kinds of issues, about the obligation of burial and the Isser deriving benefit. There's another interesting body preservation shiloh which entered the halachic literature. For those of you who've ever walked into a university college in London, there's an interesting shiloh presented to Diane Grossnas. University College actually is a very popular college for the Orthodox Jewish community in London. Inside the center hall for many years, although I don't think he sits there today, is the body of a man by the name of Jeremy Bentham. For those of you who studied philosophy, Jeremy Bentham followed the utilitarian philosophers and was a very popular philosopher at his time. And this was a time also where there was debates about anatomical dissection and procuring human bodies for dissection. So before he died, he left a very detailed will that he wanted his body dissected. He made invitations to send to all the royalty and famous people in England to attend his dissection, chose a pathologist and anatomist to perform that dissection, and then in addition requested that afterwards his bones be rearticulated and placed in the clothes that he designated with the cane and hat that he designated. And so they did. And that body was placed in University College for many years. In fact, they used to bring that body in to the board meetings at University College. I'm not sure if he was voting or not. Some people may have propped his hand up to give an additional vote to their side. His head actually was preserved for many years atop his body, the actual embalmed head, but unfortunately decomposed. You can actually see the decomposed head on the bottom, and they replaced it with a wax model. And the wax model was made by, see if you can guess, the most famous wax modelist, Madame Tussaud herself. Madame Tussaud herself made the wax model of the head of Jeremy Bentham. So the shiloh that he dealt with Diane Grossnas is this an issue of Tumas Mace? Because there's actually a full skeleton, which is Metame Tumas Oil, which conveys impurity in a tent, in an enclosure, which clearly University College is. It was a non-Jewish body, which was part of the discussion. Could Kohanim attend? Could Kohanim not attend? And he passed him at the end, based on a lengthy analysis of the composition of the case and other features, that in extenuating circumstances, it would be permitted for Kohanim to attend. The new iteration of body preservation is the so-called bodies exhibit, which started a number of years ago. The bodies exhibit, by the way, you will see these artistic formations of the bodies exhibit really trace its traces its history back to Vesalius, Andreas Vesalius from the 1500s. On the tour, we're going to see the very first edition, 1546 edition from Basel, of the work which changed history, and we'll talk about its Jewish origins. So that's a little history of body preservation in the past. What about cryopreservation or body preservation in the present? So we are going to talk about modern uses of cryopreservation, and there are a number of such uses: cryopreservation of reproductive tissue, cryopreservation of organs, which is a very new frontier, trauma resuscitation, body preservation for organ harvest, and body preservation for future resuscitation, which is called cryonics. Reproductive tissue. Frozen sperm serve at womb temperature. The freezing of reproductive tissue goes back a number of decades. This is, most of this is not a new technology. Some of this is newer. So the sperm has been frozen since the 1950s, 1960s. The first people that actually froze the human sperm, the human male reproductive tissue, was actually the space project, NASA. Because they were sending people up to space with a high probability that they would never be returning. And they actually pioneered the technology of freezing the human sperm to give the families the option to use that reproductive seed for subsequent production of children. So that's been around for decades. Embryos has been around for also a number of years already. The ability to freeze the fertilized human embryo, cryopreserve that, has been around for also quite some time. The newest kid on the block, if you will, is the human egg, the freezing of the human egg. Now you may ask, what's such a big deal? Why couldn't they freeze the human egg decades ago like they did the human sperm? The answer is the human egg is comprised of a significant amount of water in the cell. So it sounds very simple, and to a certain extent it is very simple, but when you freeze something which has a high water content, when you try and thaw it out, it can crack or it can create destruction of the cell. So being able to freeze it, rapid freeze it, and thaw it in a way which would preserve its use and fertility eluded scientists until just a few years ago, and the technology has been developed. It's still being continued in its development, but it is now able to freeze just a human egg. We talked about last night briefly the egg freezing in the Jewish world. Let's chill. These are actual real advertisements for egg freezing events, to advertise egg freezing. So this is not a cartoon or a joke. This is actually a real advertisement. Egg freezing parties. This is a cake. Freeze your eggs. It's a very popular development in the 21st century. There are a number of reasons we showed this picture of Angelina Jolie yesterday. There are a number of reasons for which eggs can be frozen. Eggs can be frozen to provide eggs for those who need eggs, who don't have their own eggs, who want to avail themselves of assisted reproduction and fertility treatment. They can be frozen for fertility preservation in cancer. So if someone, God forbid, is undergoing chemotherapy or radiation therapy, which would harm their eggs, they can take out the eggs beforehand, freeze the eggs. It's not necessarily so simple because you have to induce ovulation. Sometimes ovulation can exacerbate certain cancers, so it's going to depend on the circumstance. Or they can be harvested directly. And then freeze those eggs to be used, God willing, the person recovers from cancer, they can be used at a subsequent stage. This is the one which related to Angelina Jolie, undergoing prophylactic ovary removal for the BRCA gene. So someone, this is an interesting discussion which we've had here at this conference over the years, some excellent discussions. You can look in the archives on the BRCA gene and the halachic ramifications. But one of the important ramifications is whether someone should undergo a prophylactic surgery to remove the ovaries. And if you do that, obviously, in the Torah world, where you're interested in improve and be fruitful and multiply, if you have a 30-year-old woman who hasn't yet had children, who finds out that she's BRCA positive, if she has the surgery, it would preclude her from fulfilling that mitzvah peruvus. So should she wait till she has a child or two and then remove the ovaries? But at least the option of having some ovarian tissue or eggs frozen is an important option to preserve fertility for later on. This I won't belabor now, but this is the card here. It says, let's stop rushing to find husbands and start rushing to freeze our eggs. So this is the issue in the modern era of just for social reasons for women who are freezing their eggs, and in the Jewish community to freeze eggs if they haven't yet found their shidduch. An idea of how egg freezing is infiltrating the business community. A number of years ago, Facebook and Apple now pay for women who work for their company to freeze their eggs. And in recent development, the Pentagon offers to store eggs and sperm to retain young troops. Now, what's the svara? It's a lot of money to freeze eggs. Freezing sperm isn't so much money. So the logic is, especially in the military, you have a lot of women that start a military career, then they become pregnant, and they have to stop their military career. So if they can freeze their eggs and delay conception to a later stage, the military can retain these female troops for a lot longer. So it's fascinating how it's infiltrated the Jewish community. And we said a number of postkim, including Rabbi Asher Weiss and Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Lichtenstein, as Zatzal, have been on board with the concept of egg freezing in the Jewish community. Another aspect of freezing is the posthumous use of cryopreserved reproductive seed, which has received some attention, but I think needs to receive a little more attention. We are freezing everything now in the reproductive world. We're freezing eggs, we're freezing sperm, we're freezing fertilized embryos. And right now, we don't know how long these could be preserved and ultimately thawed for use, but in theory, they can be frozen for decades, perhaps even centuries. So the prospect of a person carrying a child of their great 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 grandfather is not such a crazy reality. And the cross-generation and cross-time use of reproductive seed is a bizarre prospect. And I don't think the medical community has given enough thought to this, but it requires a fair amount of thought. But there are interesting halachic ramifications about the posthumous use of cryopreserved seed. So for example, and there are now cases, this isn't science fiction, there are now a number of cases specifically of men. You know, we talked about that NASA allowed the men to freeze their sperm before they went up to space. Now, most militaries, the United States and Israel, offer their soldiers the option to freeze their reproductive seed before they go up to the front. And there have been a number of cases where, tragically, the soldiers, both in the United States and in Israel and other places, have died, and the families want to utilize that reproductive seed for subsequent reproduction. There's a case now, which was just recently decided in Israel, of a person who died, a soldier who died tragically in an accident. His sperm was not harvested beforehand, but literally at the time of death, they did a sperm extraction. And the parents, and he was a married man, his widow subsequently married and had her own children with a second husband. The grandparents wanted to use that sperm to produce a child, a grandchild, and they would have hired a surrogate, both a donor egg and a surrogate mother to produce that child. And the widow, who had now moved on with her life and had the additional children, said, you know, I don't want to have another child from a husband that's tragically passed away. I've now started a new life. So there are many, many halachic questions. That itself is a full hour discussion about all the halachic ramifications. But some of the halachic issues that deal with post-mortem use include, is paternity status conferred? So if someone has a child a year or two after they die, is the father who produced that sperm, who's died years earlier, considered the halachic father of that child? Does the child inherit? And so if the father, for example, had other children and that 5 years later, this child is born from cryopreserved sperm, can he then, you know, when he gets older, go back to his paternal brothers and say, you know, give me a share of the Yerusha? Does this impact Yibum, the performance of the levirate marriage ceremony, where generally if a woman dies, if a man dies and he has no children, the wife has to undergo either a chalitza or a Yibum, from the existing brothers. If there is sperm in the bank that could potentially be used for subsequent reproduction, does that preclude the necessity of performing this chalitza? And the answer to that is probably not. But again, there's a nuanced halachic discussion and ownership issues. Who owns this sperm, which is being debated in the Israeli courts, now. So that's a very, very brief overview of some of the issues of reproduction and freezing and reproduction. A new frontier is the freezing of organs. Now, why is the freezing of organs a halachic issue? So right now, there are not too many organs. So organ transplantation has really advanced tremendously. Many, many organs can be transplanted. You probably have to ask the question, a simpler question is how many organs cannot be transplanted? Because now skin, eyes, bone, pancreas, liver, intestine, cartilage, almost everything from the human body can be transplanted. And there are serious halachic issues, which we have discussed at these conferences as well, including, nivul hameis, hanas hameis, deriving benefit from the body, desecrating the body, the obligation to bury, so someone might not necessarily be able to donate organs, the definition of death, many, many different issues. But one of the issues which has arisen with only a few organs is, let me just backstep for a moment. So if the circumstances are right and the stars align, then organ transplantation could be halachically permitted. If there is someone who can directly and immediately benefit from the harvest from a body. And that was actually the tshuva of the No de Yehuda, which we alluded to very briefly from the 1700s, that if there's a cholo lefonenu, if there's someone who can benefit, then we can override the prohibitions that relate to the dead body of burial and desecration, etc., and we can perform an organ harvest. Now, what about organs that can be banked and not used immediately? Can you bank an organ and not use it now? Does that meet the halachic threshold? So until now, the only organs that could really be safely banked are skin, bone, and eyes. Those can be banked for quite a period of time. But livers, lungs, hearts, and kidneys are harvested for immediate use. There is no preservation of these organs. There is no banking of these organs. It's simply not possible, or hasn't yet been. So the poskim with respect to, this is the famous tshuva of the Noz Behuda, said that you've got gallstones, kidney stones, and bladder stones. Welcome to the Stone Age. there were interesting halachic discussions a number of years ago when in Israel they talked about establishing a skin bank. Can you preserve the skin for a period of time? Because after all, the Noz Behuda only allowed in cases where there's a cholo lefanenu. So after a lengthy discussion, there are those who came down against, those who came down for. This is a Mashash and Rabbi Israeli. They permitted skin banks because their belief was that the unfortunate reality is that, especially in Israel tragically, that a skin bank is largely used for people who are victims of burns, sometimes victims of trauma, a lot of soldiers. So even though you would harvest skin and put it in a bank, the likelihood is pretty high that skin would be used in a relatively short period of time. They extended, if you will, or expanded the definition of lefanenu to allow skin banking, which made sense. But would that apply to solid organs? And here, this is actually technology coming from Israel. Hebrew U, IceTech, could end the organ shortage. And this is from March of 2017. Will we be able to cryogenically freeze organs one day? A milestone in cryobiology announced this week is literally heartwarming. A new nanoparticle technology warmed and cryopreserved heart valves and blood vessels without damaging the tissue. So envision banks now, which not only freeze skin and bone and corneas, but you could have banks that freeze kidneys, livers, hearts, and lungs. That would necessitate a reevaluation from a Halachic perspective, whether indeed one could harvest and preserve those. I mean, right now, there are 150,000 people in the United States that are awaiting organs, and if you log on to UNOS, United Network of Organ Sharing.org, that list actually is updated daily. So you can see that list will go up or go down. Hopefully it goes down, but there's two reasons it goes down. It goes down because someone may have gotten an organ. It goes down tragically because someone, Rahman al-Islam, died on the waiting list. So if you have 150,000 people waiting, so maybe banking, because there's a list, will be halakhically permitted. But it's possible that if this technology evolves, that in 10, 20 years from now, there'll be nobody on the list. Then you're going to have a halakhic discussion about whether it's permitted to preserve or not. Here's a very fascinating new technology. Cryopreserving the entire body for organ preservation or resuscitation. Now, what do I mean by organ preservation or resuscitation? There's actually two very interesting protocols that are now experimental protocols that are going on in hospitals across the United States. One protocol is to take someone on the verge of death who sustained major trauma, who normally would bleed so significantly they'd exsanguinate within a relatively short period of time, and would not be able to be survived, to be saved, no matter what the great technology that we have. So the experiment here is to take these major trauma patients, literally cryopreserve, freeze the entire body, to allow the physicians to work their magic, to restore blood, to repair injuries, to do other sorts of things. And this is a very extreme end stage circumstance, only for people who would really otherwise not survive. Then there's another protocol, which is a simultaneous protocol, which is the objective there is to provide organs which wouldn't necessarily be able to otherwise be preserved by freezing the human body after cardiac death. So right now, most of the donations are from brain death. Once the heart stops, the clock starts ticking on organs in a cardiac dead patient, and they're not viable for that long a period of time. So the theory is, if you cryopreserve, literally fast freeze the body after death, then you can preserve those organs and ultimately use them for transplantation. So there's some hospitals that offer both. So the question is, which one are you going to offer? Which one are you going to offer the patients? The one which will potentially preserve life, or the ones which will preserve their organs? And it's an interesting thing. Now, just to share with you very briefly, the comparison of these two procedures, which populations are these procedures being used for? So the patient population for the emergency resuscitation are cardiac arrests from trauma, exclusively trauma. The ones to preserve organs are for all cardiac deaths. In the trauma case, the cryopreservation takes place before death. In the other case, it takes place after death. And there are some side halachic issues. For example, you have to remove all the blood of the body and replace it with a special solution.
That's embalming.
I'm sorry?
That's embalming.
So in a certain sense, it's like a cryo-embalming. It's like an embalming concept. They would also remove the entire blood circulation. And there are halachic issues. What do you do with the blood? You have a chiyuv kvura. You have an obligation to bury that blood. Are you allowed to do these procedures at all? Because, again, the nivul hames, it's a desecration of the body. What are the potential benefits? This is a very new technology, and halachic literature has not yet evolved on this. But the basic issues are, in all these procedures, large catheter insertion and blood replacements are for the sake of pikuach nefesh and thus permitted in the resuscitation protocol. So in the trauma cases, you're doing it solely to save the patient, so all this would clearly be mutter. Blood would not require burial in that case, because if the patient is still technically alive at the time of the procedure, the blood is taken from a living person, and there's no obligation to bury the blood if it's harvested from a living person. The halachic obligations in the organ preservation protocol, which is for patients who have sustained death and they want to just preserve the organs, in this case, all the procedures are for the sake of donation and pikuach nefesh, and would be permitted according to those poskim who would allow donation, of course. Blood may require burial as it's removed after halachic death. So So now let's move on to our final frontier for the last few moments. What do all these people have in common? John F. Kennedy, Ted Williams, and Walt Disney.
Edison's
cryopreserved.
They are all believed to be cryopreserved or frozen. And this unknown we'll talk about in just a moment. Whether it's true, I don't know if anybody really knows the absolute truth on this one, but people believe that Walt Disney is frozen. Ted Williams we know is frozen, and I'll show you a picture of Ted Williams in just a moment. So they all have potentially undergone what's called cryonics. Now what is cryonics? It says your food is frozen, your sperm is frozen, why shouldn't you be frozen? That's the pitch from the Cryonics Institute. So the concept with cryonics, which is we'll talk about for just a few moments before we close, is that the technology doesn't exist today to save us and preserve our bodies. Why don't we freeze our bodies? Don't let us decompose. Don't bury us. Keep us as complete and whole as possible, because who knows? After enough conferences here at Torrey Motion, scientists will figure out how to actually resurrect or resuscitate this frozen body, alter all those things which cause the death of the body, and bring that body back to life. Not such a crazy, maybe 100 years ago is a crazy idea. Today, it's not such a crazy idea. And the most famous, this is Alcor, one of the famous cryonic institutes. This is their protocols. First of all, they start the protocol after the legal death, because you could argue maybe you should do the protocol before they actually die, but they actually legally are unable to do that for obvious reasons. So they wait till there's complete pronouncement of death. Circulation is restored, the lungs may be ventilated, medications are administered to protect against clotting. The patient's blood, as we said, is replaced with the vitrification solution, etc. And just this past year, a teenager in England won a battle. Teenager wins battle to have her body cryogenically frozen. She's a 14-year-old who died from cancer. And she petitioned to have her body frozen because she's fantasizing, maybe one day I'll come back to life. And the doctors will figure out what's wrong and I'll be able to come back to life. And they actually acceded to her request and they allowed her to be cryonically frozen. They have an option, by the way, apropos our discussion last night about head transplants, just to freeze the brain alone. Because maybe they could find another body for that brain subsequently. Of course, that's a cheaper option for those people wanting to economize. Ted Williams, actually, this is the head of Ted Williams. You can read online the story about Ted Williams and what happened to his body in the cryonics, very interesting. So there you go, halachic shilas about this. Really, you can assimilate some of the previous literature to these kinds of discussions. But just a heads up, there is a discussion mentioned in the halachic literature of something which might seem to be cryonics, but it's actually not. Shiachantua chanita nikreis freezing. So there was some modified form of body preservation prior to burial. In the halachic literature, that is not talking about cryonics specifically. But the halachic issues of cryonics are similar to embalming, though with intent to resuscitate. So it's very different in that perspective. So nibulames, the desecration of the body, keeping the body above ground, et cetera, et cetera. Let me just end with the following thought experiment. What if cryonics actually become successful? And I don't know if you ever saw this movie, Forever Young. So for those of you who didn't, it's a story of a military experiment where they actually froze someone who either was on the verge of death or had actually died, was left in some garage, military garage, and then a couple decades later actually wakes up and returns to life. And the experiment was a success. So the question is, if cryonics works and someone's considered halachically or legally dead, and then a year, 2 years, 5 years, however many years later, they are able to be resurrected or resuscitated, what are the halachic ramifications? So for example, is there tuma? So tuma is conferred on the corpse, but when the person wakes up again, is he still the conveyor of tuma? Because after all, he was dead for all this period of time. Yerusha, inheritance, marriage, let's say his wife is still alive, does he have to remarry his wife? Can he still remain married to his wife from before? Lest you think that this was not discussed by earlier authorities, this actually has been discussed in the halachic literature. There has been a number of cases of resuscitation in rabbinic literature. Eliyahu resuscitated a ben HaTzarfatit. Elisha resuscitated the ben HaShunamit. And some people think, by the way, that this is the forebearer to modern CPR or mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because of the form the resuscitation took place. And the Gemara actually asks, returning to Lot, Ishto Shalot, Mahu Shetitani. Does pillar of salt convey Tuma today in the 21st century? So the Gemara says, Mace Matame, the Ainitzid Melach Matame. A corpse conveys Tuma, but a pillar of salt does not convey Tuma. But the next one is more relevant to us. Ben Ashunamis, the son of the Shunamis who was resuscitated by Elisha, Mahu Sheyitame. And Rashi says, Mahu Sheyitame La'achar Shehechiyahu. Once he's resuscitated and returned to life, does he still convey Tumah or not? Because the Tumah had rested upon him at that time. And with respect to marriage, there are actually serious halachic discussions about remarrying after resuscitation. So there's a famous passage, and we'll close in just 2 minutes. There's a famous passage from the Gemara Megillah, Amar Rava, a famous story of Rabba and Reb Zeira. They had a suda together, and they got a little inebriated, and Rabba actually got up and decapitated Reb Zeira. And he died. But then Rabba prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he was brought back to life. So he invited him to the suda the next year. He said, "Do you want to come spend the suda with me? I'd love to spend it with you." So he says, "Thanks, but no thanks." But the halachic shilas that were discussed by Proskim, and this is from the Chidah, did Reb Zeira have to remarry his wife? It's a serious halachic shaila because he was dead for that period of time, and death breaks the marital bond. So he has discussion that he paskins that as long as he remained unburied and it wasn't final, so to speak, then the marriage is not dissolved, and in fact he didn't have to remarry. And this, by the way, relates to cardiac bypass. Whether you have to remarry your wife after cardiac bypass, or for those who are familiar with ECMO, and there was a story, it turned out to be a false story, that Diane Yechezkel Roth recovered from a massive heart attack, had to remarry his wife anew because he underwent cardiac bypass, because in a certain sense he was dead for that period of time. But we don't paskin that way. But the bottom line is we would have to revisit those issues in the world of cryonics, where a person would be, quote, dead for not just a minute, an hour, a day, but actually a year's time. So in conclusion, it says here, it has been 3 days. I think we can safely say that their efforts to resuscitate you have failed. We don't know about what the world of resuscitation holds. So 3 days may have been something for that cartoon, but in 10 years, 20 years, 100 years from now, people may be able to be resuscitated after a long period of time.